We've been going through the Sermon on the Mount, and we begin into Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7, we're going to look at four messages, and each message, I think of as sort of like a life path. You're going down life, and there's a chance to go one of two ways, and each of these four topics in Matthew 7 are really important. And how you end up living your life in these four areas is really important. A lot of times we just sort of live our life on autopilot. And here Jesus says, as we finish up the Sermon on the Mount, to give careful attention to this. We are going to look at a very familiar piece of Scripture today. In fact, part of this Scripture is probably the most well-known verse out there in our secular culture of any. But it's probably one of the most misunderstood verses in our secular culture. There are three particular things that he tells us in how we are to treat our brothers and sisters in the Lord. And then he tells us how to relate to those people who are fools, who are just evil, who, no matter how well-intentioned you may be to try to be of benefit and a blessing to them, they just will not let you. Difficult people, difficult relationships. And then he finishes with, again, another one of the most well-known verses in all the world. We start out with our attitude towards our brothers, and as our secular culture could fill in the blank here, judge not. I mean, virtually everybody I know, whether you go to the church or not, knows that those two words, judge not. And he says, do not judge, or you too will be judged. Now, before we look at what he means here, what I'd like to do is think about, what does this not mean? Does it mean that I'm supposed to pretend that people aren't doing bad things? Am I to turn just a blind eye as if something didn't happen? That's not what he means. Do I just sort of go on and just decide I'm just going to be positive no matter what? That's not what he's saying here either. Judge not, or you too will be judged. Now, before we look at what he does mean, there is one large misconception that I want to address here. And that is, within the church, there is a place to judge. But I don't mean judge by our attitude, which is what we typically think of. That is to think about the situations of which people are involved, and when somebody brings shame, public shame, upon the name of Christ, we are not, to judge not does not mean we sit by and just hope it goes away and maybe it will fix itself. In 1 Corinthians, there was a situation in the church there where there was a man who was sexually involved with his father's wife. And when Paul hears news of this, he writes in 1 Corinthians, you mean you guys haven't done anything about this yet? It just goes on and on. Nobody's jumping in. In fact, he had heard word that in some ways, some of the folks in the church thought they were sort of being a little bit avant-garde about this. Wow, we're sort of out there. We're kind of the cool people doing this. He's got ready to pull his hair out. He said, aren't there some discriminating men, discriminating in terms of thinking and using judgment, not attitude, but your thinking caps that can see what's going on, and someone needs to talk to this man to help him. That is an appropriate use of judging. Now, to say that, you have to, because there's such a brand here of a judging attitude, that is not what he means. He's using our head to help somebody move towards Christ-likeness. What does he mean? James 4:12 will give us some indication here. There is only one lawgiver and judge, him who is able to save and destroy. But who are you that you judge your neighbor? Now, James picks up sort of the same idea, and I think the heart of what Jesus is saying has to do something like this. Our word judge as a verb is similar to the noun judge. And my wife loves to watch Judge Judy. Anybody else like to watch Judge Judy? Any judge in America sits up high above everyone else in the courtroom, and there's a reason for that. The reason for that is it implies authority with which to make a judgment. This is the image that is drawn here in James chapter 4, that Jesus has this position, God the Father has this position, but we are not to take that superior position to someone else. We usually don't think in terms of position. What we usually think of in terms of words. And we'll come to that in a minute. But the primary thing that he is saying here is do not take an exalted position as if you're fit to sit on the bench overlooking someone in an inferior position to you. You can do this, and I can do this, and have done this on countless occasions, unfortunately, within the scope of my two temples by being critical. And I have fought that battle all of my Christian life. And I fight that even this past week. We can do it with our words. But it starts not just with our words and not just with our head, but it starts in our heart as we think about ourselves in a superior position to our brother. And we'll come to this again in a moment. Now, when I was in a seminary years ago, I'd been a Christian by the end of seminary about 4.5, almost 5 years. And you know, seminary is good in some ways. It really helped me in some good ways. But in another way, probably the most unteachable person in all the world is a seminary graduate. You have been chock full of 3 years of information and books and the latest things that have come out. Now, you may not have hardly any experience in the real world of trying to do this, but by the end of seminary, I thought I was God's gift to the church in general. Now, it's not that I consciously thought that. It's just that my mind sort of operated in that direction. I'd be sitting at a service, and I would hear a pastor talk, and my mind might say, well, I wouldn't have said it that way. I think I would have said it this way. Why did he emphasize that instead of this? Or I'd see something going on in the church of which I was a part of, and my mind would go, hey, you know, if I was the pastor, I don't think I'd do it that way. I think there's a better way to do that. Now, this sort of got like a snowball in my life without me even knowing it. And it came to be such a part of my thinking that it was almost like I was morphing into this critic in my head, and now it was seeping out into my relationships. That damages relationships. Nobody likes to be around a critic. It doesn't matter if I think I'm being critical. What matters is, do you think I'm being critical in relationship? Now, I was at a Bible conference, and at the end of one session, the Bible speaker was speaking on pride. And during that message, it's like God came down. There's about 2,000 of us in this big auditorium. I was sitting on the front row off to the side. And it was almost like God just came down right in front of me and just sort of parted the curtains in my soul and opened the window shades of my eyes and allowed me to see just the awful little soul that I was becoming. This proud, arrogant, haughty person, shrinking down less and less and less, though being a legend in my own mind. And I was broken. I could finally see this for what it was. Just this awful, awful sense about me of pride. Now, this is what he's talking about. He's talking about something internal to us, not just our words, not just our head, but in our hearts. Now, he says not to judge, or you too will be judged. But then he says, if you won't even do it for the sake of the people in your life, at least do it out of self-interest, which is what verse 2 says. For in the same way that you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. So here the principle is simply this. If I take out my, thank you. If I take out my Inspector Do-Right hat. And I take out my magnifying glass. Just on autopilot. Don't even have to think about this. And look at, what are you doing? Then why are you doing what you're doing? And start to assume the worst of motives about what you're doing. Two things are going to happen, this verse says. First is, that same measurement God will use with you. Okay. It's like God says, all right, you want to be nitpicky about all these little things? You think that's a good idea? Maybe I should do that with you. Now, second thing here is, and with the measure used, it will be measured to you. This happens with people. Over time in your family or with your spouse or with your people at work that know you or your neighbors, over a long period of time, they figure out what hat you're wearing and what pipe you're smoking. And they figure out the magnifying glass that you use. They hear it in your words. And they discern it in your attitude. And you know what we do? We train them how to think about ourselves. We will find people being just as picky with us as we are with others. We train them. And if we complain that others are being too picky with me, what we don't usually think of is, I've trained them well. Let's look on the inside of your handout. First thing he says is don't be a judge. Don't elevate yourself to a superior position. Second is don't be a hypocrite. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your eye? Now, this is a rhetorical question. But I think of this question as sort of the 90-10 rule. Whenever I have a disagreement or the beginnings of a conflict, virtually every time my mind starts out on this ground. I know I may be 10% wrong, but he or she is 90% wrong. Now, that's how it seems to me. Now, I'm not saying that's correct. That's just my autopilot start. Now, that's what he's saying here. That should not be surprising to us. If what we think is the other person is 90% wrong, and I'm only 10% wrong, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye? Why do you look? That's a rhetorical question. How can you do that? Don't you see what idiocy this is to start out with that 10 and 90 thing? That's not how it really is. And he draws this sort of really funny picture of a person over here who has a speck of sawdust in their eye, and here I am thinking that I'm going to do LASIK surgery on this person. But what I cannot see, and here is the irony of this particular image, I'm going to do eye surgery, and at the same time, I am blind to what is apparent to everybody else who looks at me. The eye surgeon has a plank in his eye. He doesn't see. Here's a couple cartoons that we have. Let's throw these up. Now, what he's saying is the person in blue genuinely believes that there's something wrong with the person wearing red. And something obviously must be done to help that poor person. Jesus is drawing this kind of caricature. Let's go to the next one. There's another one. Like this one. The person's got a little speck in their eye. They're trying to get it out. The person with a red face is just as sure as they can be. They know what to do. This is the 90-10 rule. Let's go to Matthew 7:4. How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? Now, what's obvious here is that all of us have a plank, or many planks, or a lumberyard. in our own life. We call these blind spots. I think that term doesn't do us justice or the severity of our problem. Verse 5, you hypocrite. First take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Now, what is it that makes, why does he say, if you try to be the person in blue with the plank, and you're trying to remove the speck out of the other person who's wearing red, what is it about that that makes you a hypocrite? Is it because you're trying to fix the other person? That's not what makes you a hypocrite. What makes the person in blue a hypocrite with the plank is that they are all too willing to fix the person wearing red with their speck, while they are unwilling to admit what is obvious to everybody in the whole world, that they also need fixing. This is the twin brother of the attitude of the judge. The superior position. This is what he's saying here, is this is the person who sort of, without using these words, has this attitude of something like this. I know you have a problem, and I'm going to be magnanimous and try to come along and help. And I hope you'll appreciate my help. And if I run into some kind of resistance on your part, I'm going to think something like, well, this person is obviously unteachable. What I can't see is the lumberyard in my own eye. Now, the third thing he says, relating to brothers and sisters in the Lord, don't be a judge, don't take a superior position, don't be a hypocrite. If you're willing to help someone else with something, are you just as willing for someone else to help you with your stuff? Now he says, he comes back to the position. Attitude to the brothers is to be a brother. It's not the position of superior to inferior, it is equals. And as Christians, it doesn't matter if you're one day old in the Lord or if you're 42 years old in the Lord. In this sense, we are equals. Same level, brothers and sisters. He says, you hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Now, there's only really one word here I think it's important, and it's the word first. Before you try to give somebody some advice or some constructive criticism, or just something to mull over and think about, or something to pray about, you have work to do. And so do I. And if you and I don't do that work first, don't be surprised if you meet resistance or somebody that doesn't like your input. Galatians 6:1 carries sort of the same idea. Brothers, if someone is caught in a sin, you who are spiritual should restore him gently. This is the word restore is the Greek word that means to mend a broken arm. You don't go in there just going, all right, what's wrong? Broken arm, all right, hey. All right, bring over some wood. Let's make the splint. How's that? You come as one who understands what it means to have a broken arm, how difficult and painful this is, and you respond gently. If you can't pull that gently off yet, you are not qualified yet to speak. Now, when I think about this in my own life, when I think about the plank in my own eye, one of the things I think about is the magic wand question. This really helps me a lot. If I want to talk to my wife or one of my kids about something, or one of my friends in the church or one of the leaders in our church, one of the things I think about, and occasionally do, although not with these words, this is the shorthand version of this, is, if there was one thing you would like me to grow in, one thing that you could pick that would make a big difference in my life, if God were at work, what would you pick? That's the magic wand question. That's what he's talking about here. If I'm not willing to ask that question of someone else who is my brother or sister, then I am not yet qualified to come along and take the speck out of someone else's eye. The magic Magic wand question. Now, then he turns to attitude towards fools. Watch what you say. Attitude towards fools. I've talked to a number of people who are in very, very difficult relationships, very difficult marriages. For some, very difficult teenagers or very difficult older adults. And what you have discovered, much to your chagrin, is that you really can't almost say virtually anything in this arena without just making somebody mad. And Jesus addresses that. Do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. Now, this is not a disparaging language. What he's saying is there's something different about people who are foolish. In Proverbs, foolish is a technical term. A fool can be somebody who won't listen to advice, who thinks they don't need any help, and they don't need any help especially from you. Or they don't need any help from God. I already know what to do. That's a fool or an evil person that can only see about this far beyond their own nose. Now, he uses two images to describe these two pictures. One is dogs. Again, not a disparaging term. In those days, most dogs were wild dogs. And a wild dog would eat, in our day, in downtown city, out of a trash bin, a dumpster. And they really wouldn't know that much difference or care that much difference whether they ate out of a dumpster or whether you took something out of a steakhouse and gave it to them. A wild dog is a wild dog. It's not discriminating about what it eats. And then the second image he uses is one of pigs. Now, what's true of pigs? The thing we think about most is pigs have no appreciation for being clean. You can wash a pig, and as soon as you release it, it's going to find a place to jump in mud and wallow. Now, these are metaphors for fools. If you do give dogs what is sacred or throw pearls to pigs, they may trample them underfoot. In other words, they're not going to value what you're saying or what God's word says nearly as much as you do. This should not be a surprise, as he warns us. They may trample them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces. Now, I was bitten by a St. Bernard when I was going on a babysitting assignment when I was in high school. I have an appreciation for this particular image. I went up to the fence where the St. Bernard was in the backyard, and it was just sitting there looking at me, and I walk up to pet it. The next thing I knew, that St. Bernard tried to take a chunk out of my nose. This is the image he's describing here. There are just some people in your life and some people in my life that will disregard what you have to say or devalue it or say things like, who are you to tell me what to do? Now, when you run into those people, this is your verse. And there are some people in my life, sadly, and perhaps I'm one of these people to some of you, where you just have to really watch what you say and how you say it. And you really can't say all that you wish you could. The last thing, 2 Peter 2 gives the same image. Of them, Proverbs are true. A dog returns to its vomit, not very discriminating about what it eats. A sow that is washed goes back to her wallowing in the mud. Proverbs 29:9. If a wise man has an argument with a fool, the fool only rages and laughs, scoffs, gets angry, thinks you're a numbskull. And there is no quiet, meaning there is no peace. Back your hand out, Proverbs 9:8. Do not reprove a scoffer, or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man, he will love you. Give instruction to a wise man, he will be still wiser. Teach a righteous man, and he will increase in learning. We have to be discriminating about what we say and to who what we say to. Then he finishes with, again, one of the most well-known verses in all the world, what we call the Golden Rule. In everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. Now, in ancient literature, there is the Golden Rule in some of the different religions, but they're all spoken in the negative sense. what you don't want somebody to do to you, don't do that to others. But this is the first time where it pops up in the positive. So, for example, let's say you and your wife are talking, husband and wife are talking, and your wife shares something that's really tough for her. And you're tempted, guys, to do something stupid, like try to offer a suggestion of help and try to fix it. But you have had that plane blown out of the sky before. And you say to yourself, I'm not going to try to fix it. Now, that's the negative of the golden rule. You've done something good. But he's saying something more here. It's not just not do what you wouldn't want done to you, but try to think of what you would do if you were in that situation. So in this case, instead of fix, I might say something like, I'm so sorry this happened. And let those words just sort of linger in the air. Because that's what you wish somebody would say to you when you feel like a failure. I'm so sorry you have to live with this. Now, how do you do that? I think of two simple things. The first one is use your imagination. Use your imagination. You have to imagine, what if I was in their shoes? What if I was experiencing the kind of failure they just told me about? Or the kind of defeat? Or the kind of discouragement? Or the kind of anxiety? Or the kind of depression? Or the loss of a dream? What if that was me? You use your imagination. And then you simply ask yourself, what would I want to hear? What do I wish somebody would verbalize to me in that particular situation? That's the golden rule. And at the end of this verse, he says, this sums up the law and the prophets. Something along this line. You mean to tell me that if I didn't read the whole Old Testament, just little bits and pieces of it, do you mean to tell me that all of those chapters, those 39 books, that is the Reader's Digest version of what I'm supposed to pick up from the Old Testament? Jesus says, yes. That's it.